Welcome to Apostrophe Cast. At the end of October, as adults start to figure out what kinds of costumes they want to wear to their offices, it seems appropriate to listen to Ryan Wilson, a person who has gone into that place between adulthood and childhood where most of us live and found the most profound moments. In the tradition of Donald Justice and Stanley Plumlee, we bring you Ryan Wilson.
Hi, I'm Ryan Wilson. I'm going to read 8 poems, but before I get started, I want to say thank you to John Woods and to Apostrophe Cast for letting me read. The first poem I'll read is called Tagging. The title comes from graffiti. When one wants to sign a work of graffiti, obviously you don't want to use your real name, or else you would be arrested and put in jail. So you come up with a tag. And this is usually a creative way of writing your own name or maybe a nickname, and it just lets everybody know whose graffiti they're looking at. It's called tagging. Just outside of town, where kudzu like a mad king ruled the roadside woods, and where the few unvanquished pines crackled in midsummer's swelter, we stood beside the railroad tracks that ran opposite the highway, and our shirtless torsos slick with sweat shook up cans of combustible paint, then sprayed on the rusted metal sides of a halted train the things we carried inside us. Nature's a whore in green, or man down in orange, claiming them with our tags, those colorful, curiously shaped scrawlings we'd practiced for hours in notebooks. The characters blended together as if who we were was really one difficult and elaborate letter from a language no one but us could understand, from the untranslatable tongue of teenage boys with nothing to do on a sunny Saturday but break rules, a wild dialect which, for all its apparent illegibility, was ours, looping and swerving out of our imaginations. And even as we saw the police cruiser pull off onto the highway's shoulder, we didn't think of our parents' dismay, the muffled agony they slouched into every day like a dentist's waiting room. Nor did we think of what punishment was waiting for us back down the highway in the world of summer jobs and minimum wage, report cards, laundry, and hamburger helper. We only thought of our messages, our names in bright colors rolling across a cloudless countryside, past sprawling, open fields of wind-swept wheat, past the hushed brick squares of dying country towns, beside shaded lakes and over inner-city bridges, passing through years like the quick dark of tunnels, and arriving on the other side of decades unchanged, a signal, a sign, an unending advertisement for our existence that would flash across the screen of the world for anyone who cared to see it. So we kept tagging the boxcars, rushing as if it were a matter of life and death, all the while keeping one eye on the fierce swirl of oranges and greens, the other on the marching midnight blue uniform headed right for us. The next poem I'll read is called The Shed. When it's taken you 15 years to walk across the yard, and you climb up the splintering wooden steps, the sun still high overhead, and open the door to your shed, you'll find whatever's left of your past waiting exactly where you put it down. You'll find in that familiar dark the torn green fabric of a suitcase still packed for some journey you never took. You'll find your old microscope, a child's clothes, the bat you were sure would hit the winning home run, rotten coils of rope that slid burning through your fingers years ago. And there, behind the debris, behind all the unused tools, you'll find, sitting on some high shelf, covered by rust and grime, colored like a scab, the chest you used to fill with things you loved. Open it. Let your fingers explore what's inside. You'll lift a fistful of yellow Polaroids that prove you weren't always this way. Once you were a blue-eyed boy, smiling on Christmas morning, your head overwhelmed by a big red Santa hat. All the gifts you were given are here now, in this shed, if they still exist. Imagine your presents, the paper red, orange, or pink, the ribbons green, blue, or silver, all the bright packages you held in your cupped hands like fire, left out here in the dark, with the dust sifting down on them. Years of snow. Lift now from the bottom of the chest the heaviest thing you feel. You'll hold a tarnished silver frame, exquisite flowers gone black, and in its ruined glass you'll see clearly the wrinkles carved crudely in your sagging face. Your own blear, sunken eyes will accuse you. Yes, you have made something of yourself. You've really shown them. The boy from the photos has waited in the forgotten dark of this tin box through summer's stifling heat and winter's deepest cold, waited for this day, for you to open the door, the light at your back, and rummage in silence through all that you let go, believing you might be able to save something. He's waited for this moment, the mirror lifted, to tell you, you're too late. The next poem that I'll read is a shorter poem, and it's entitled Lament. After you were gone too, I packed my bags and drove south to the beach, where we all used to dance away our summers. For days I sat in the hot sun through long afternoons to watch everybody pass by. A pale, doting mother, someone's tanned, romping boys, a little girl dipping her delicate big toe into the ocean for the first time. I never saw the same face twice. Tonight, the roaring waves reach farther and farther up the beach, and everyone has gone to wherever they go. I wish I knew where they went, or why. I tell myself they went home. Beneath a bone-white moon, I walk the nameless stretch at water's edge, where wet sand still clings to shore, its outline of shadowy peaks and drops jagged. A polygraph, a cardiogram, and sure to be lost by morning. The next poem is a garden poem. Recently I've been writing a number of garden poems, and this is the first of the three that I'll be reading for you. It's entitled Deadheading. For anybody who doesn't know, deadheading is the process of plucking the ruined, the dead blossoms from a flower or plant so that the plant can continue to thrive. Deadheading. Behind the front of flowers and green foliage, moribund blossoms, withered and dark, hid like reality from a madman. How could I have known until, believing in the miracle of small works, I knelt today in our garden to cut and bind what we'd planted. With faith, my hands could heal the inert half-corpse stricken by biology's cruel randomness, by genes spiked with insanity that sprawled helpless and lame across months in our bed. With faith that he would rise again and wend his way back into the bright field of your good graces. Have faith in yourself and believe in a fool. All afternoon I plucked away at nature's ruin, gently fingering each stem and stalk like a string, bending them like blue notes in a love song only you could hear. But forgiveness is a dance with steps too tricky for tired feet. When you found me begging at beauty's altar, you said it was too late for any change to make a difference. You couldn't give any more. Then you left me there, down on my knees in the garden, with the dusk coming on, my hands full of dead things I would have saved if I weren't lost in a world that wasn't there. In my cupped hands, I held the things I'd thought would spare us the endless torment of life alone, a mass of little mistakes so light they might really have been nothing. The next poem I'll read is another garden poem. It's a little bit short, or shorter for me. It's written in tetrameter couplets, and I chose the form largely because the poem is a response to Wordsworth's I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, which is also in tetrameter. I didn't steal his stanzaic form, but I thought using the meter would be appropriate. It's entitled Colloquy in a Field of Daffodils. The daffodils have just come back, their wealth alone for winter's lack. Or, maybe, witnessed properly, the field's a jackpot lottery, a fortune won free from conniving. These heralds trumpet spring's arriving, the majesty of what's not yet told, their scores composed in lines of gold that lend the field back to the trees the figure of choir-like galaxies. But here, alone, I reminisce and wonder where it is, that bliss of solitude that always gets those hearts that aren't counterfeits to dance, forgetting what before had made them count themselves as poor. The taxing times and recollection still toll like echoes no affection for flowers' flaunted ecstasy can hush. What hope is there for me? I hear each stellar phrase they coin, but theirs is a number I can't join. Though something sets my legs astir, I know those buds don't register what everybody sometime learns. Our song is one without returns. But still I stop and watch them dance in spring's unspared extravagance, and try to count, but I bungle the beat as if my heart had two left feet. The next poem I'll read is a bit longer. It's an elegy for my grandfather, Glenn Lamar Wilson. The Door. In the photograph, you sit on the porch steps, leaning toward the door, your trunk suspended in motion between your collapsed body and the work you feel compelled to do despite the chemo, the arthritic knuckles, the late December chill settling around the house. And now I pass through the threshold and watch you work, see your hands fumbling with the broken mortise lock's cylinder. The door won't stay. Behind you, a thrasher swoops, mute, from the square workshop you built and painted white and red like an ambulance. You wince, grimace, work. Did you know that this would come to pass? I remember dawns, the rising sun red as a skin knuckle. We took to the woods, thick smell of coffee and cigarettes on your breath as it bulled into the frozen air, a white helmet I thought sturdy enough never to disappear. Did you feel these concrete steps itching in your knees at night when you couldn't sleep? Did you lie awake as a young man, counting deep breaths? Did you think about the pregnant wife, the retarded son, or your drunk father, blind from Lyme disease you chased off to save your mother? And did you lie there, your eyes adjusting to the absolute dark of the country, asking what might have been, your hands clasped behind your head like a traveler being held up? Once you said the rows a man has plowed will never tell a lie. Your rows were straight, I knew, and you never had to plow a field twice because you made sure your lines were right before you plowed it once. I remember cotton. The field looking like snow the light was melting. The way your massive hands showed me how to pick it, delicate, from the thorns, to keep the seeds for later. How many seeds did you never get to plant? And yet you always worked. Measured, cut, framed, wired, plumbed, painted, planted. You shaped the world around you like a sculptor, chipping away at the crude form the earth gave you, until, slowly, it gave, and what you saw was the life you wanted to see. In those woods, teaching me how to track, to call, to press my finger through fear thick as butter on the icy trigger, were you thinking of these steps, this moment? Is that why you gave me your hunting jacket? You must have known, or I would not have felt the rough warmth of that fabric around me. You must have always felt that chill, the cold that never leaves, that makes a body suddenly shiver in the summer sun. You once told me how, in the war, the cold was so tranquil you had to cover yourself with corpses to keep from letting go. All the while you spoke, I watched your hands, those hands that knew the stillness of death, the relentless motion of building, of fixing, of work, which is life. They were giant, so large my hand vanished in one of them, a wish in a well, even the last time we met. Even days like this Sunday, when your wife is away at church and you are working through pain, like a frostbitten man walking through snow, because there is only choice and you choose this, to do with your hands the things your hands can do. Certain their work will not be perfect, will not last, but that their work is everything. Even this Sunday, you know you will have no home you don't build. In 2 weeks, you will be dead. Your family will sit in that white clapboard house you wrenched into a home, feeling the vagrant draft of the January wind make our awareness point like a hair on the back of the neck. In time, your workshop will fade from white, soften to the shade of a bloody band-aid, then be ripped off the land. Your house will be sold, and I will not look at this picture much. But sometimes I will, and I'll think of your work, our work, as I watch your fingers struggle with a piece too slight to hold, to fix a door no man can make keep shut. The next poem is another shorter poem. It's the last of the garden poems that I'll be reading. I guess I should preface it by saying there was a time when I worked for an irrigation company, putting in irrigation systems, and my job was to dig a 2-foot trench all the way around the customer's yard so that we could then put in the piping. It was pretty tough work, and it was made tougher because the machine that's supposed to dig the ditch for you, the ditch witch, died pretty early on in the summer, and in Georgia, where I grew up, the red clay in the middle of summer is pretty hard. It's a lot like a brick, you might say. But anyway, I had to work with this guy, Wormy, and I don't know why he was called Wormy, but that was his name, and I would basically swing a mattock into this red clay brick, and then Wormy would come behind me and shovel out the dirt that was broken loose. It's a very difficult job, but anyway, I wrote a poem about it, and it's called Sweat, for Dave Smith. One half a dead man deep we dug, 3 feet, 1 yard, for all the yards, The summer's heat, a swarming cloud of bees we fought, by which I mean we couldn't fight, but still the ditch we couldn't ditch got dug. I swung the mattock, and Wormy, puny, dirty, weak, asthmatic, would shovel out the crumbled dirt. Of course, the sun had baked the earth so long the force of handheld tools was insufficient, but the ditch witch died in June. Boss said, "So what?" So flowery dreams made our bodies ache. Our backs and knees caught tremors, each quick quake of pain reminding us exactly who we were. Two stupid kids, a half-assed crew installing sprinklers in suburban yards. Two grunts, a pair of pawns, your lowest cards. Still, looking back, it's not the ditch I see. It's not the crumbled earth or Worm and me hacking away for cut-rate cash, but sweat in beads, like crystals that keep what I forget. Through them, I see the lives we led back then, the beer brawls, food stamps, quarts of Bombay gin, and parties. But the closer in I zoom, the more I see bright roses in full bloom. The last poem I'll read is called Art History. I think the only preface it needs is Old Guitarist is a painting by Picasso from his Blue Period. The poem is called Art History. I recalled how we'd sit in the kitchen to paint, as if brushstrokes were biscuits, the dusk-drunk wind strumming an arpeggio on the blinds. That summer, we believed hobbies could help us forget our mistakes, the lust we'd flung all over, like the town was a canvas and we were Fidelity's Pollux. So we bought a couple paint-by-number kits. Sheepish, awkward, we followed rules like jazz lovers who find at their first lesson, sheet music for three blind mice on the piano. We were not the Picassos we'd secretly hoped we might have been. We were lucky to keep the paints from running, forming tragic, startling, capsized wrecks from our single boat on a stormy sea, a rubble from our flowered veranda, the simple, sentimental symbols botched by a cacophony of shades until they might have been nightmares, which is what our days were bleeding into. Our failures taunted us. The directions for our paintings, the figures and their corresponding colors, sneered, smug with the true design. Still, I've remembered the love we made, thought often of the desperate call and response duet our bodies moaned on boozy afternoons, the way the forgiveness we strained for forever eluded us, like high notes outside the parallel bars our voices lived in. But I had forgotten, until now, eyeing your postcard with a print of Old Guitarist, how, after each bungling of beauty, we'd lift the lid off another box and read the instructions together, while the sun sat like a squeezed orange on the treetops, the light sticking to the leaves. I had forgotten the numbered sheets, how our slight fingers followed our eyes down, and how time and again we started over, knowing one is always blue. Thank you for listening, and thanks again to Apostrophe Cast for reading. I'm Ryan Wilson, and I hope you enjoyed my poems.
Please join us on November 7th for BJ Hollers.